So, good evening, everybody. We're doing this podcast as sort of the start of 2025 for EBSWA, the Evidence-Based Social Work Alliance, to begin to put more of a public face in our work. And we've now got a revamped website, which is much more usable and appealing. And so this first meeting of 2025 will be published on the website. Now, EBSWA, the Evidence-Based Social Work Alliance, I want to just say a word about why we're needed at first, because as our name suggests, exploring and developing the evidence base for practice, specifically in the disputed area of sex and gender, is our mission. That's what we were set up to do. We formed in 2019, and our website provides a history of the work since then. We have had a lot of correspondence with regulatory bodies, with CAFCAS, the Care Inspectorate in Scotland, and with governments in England and Scotland. We've also, of course, supported social workers Rachel Mead and Lizzie Pitt and others who have faced investigation and sanction by employers and regulators. Several of the members have been investigated and had career-threatening encounters with Social Work England. And what's changed since we were established is that from our early webinars and meetings, most of our members were not able to be public about our identities, and that there was a kind of air of much greater fear, I think. And I think that has changed considerably. We do have new members and members prepared, old members as well, prepared to be identified as critical of current policy, regulation, and practice around gender and sex. So tonight, Robin, who's one of our newer members, and Emma as well, both of them are newest members to us, but have also published and spoken out and acted publicly on the issue. Both have got their own blogs, and they're going to be contributing to tonight's discussion. The discussion is being recorded, and it will go up on the website. So I'm going to ask that. First of all, I'll just say that the discussion tonight is specifically about applying the principle of the best interest of the child in addressing cases of children and teenagers who identify as the opposite sex or whose parents identify them as such, and asking what best practice should consist of. So I'm going to ask those who are taking part in the discussion just to quickly introduce themselves, and then we'll move on to Robin giving us a sort of introduction to this discussion. So,
Yeah,
Emma, do you
I'm
want
ha oh, sorry, I was going
to
to
Come on, you
introduce
go.
myself.
On you go, Robin. Yeah.
Yeah, my name's Robin. I'm a social worker in children and families with 8 years' experience, mainly working with adolescents, but also working with parents and more recently younger children as well. About 4 or 5 years of that, I've had multiple clients who have been experiencing gender questioning issues, and I have been reading and researching extensively on the topic because it sort of dragged me in, as it does all of us.
Thanks.
Hi, I'm
Charles?
Emma.
All right.
I'm a
You
social
go ahead.
worker in the southeast of England. I work with adolescents. I've only been qualified for just over 2 years, but previously I was working. I've worked for 20 years with children in the care system in some form or other, both in residential childcare, working with carers, and working with children in care. And again, like Robin, I sort of hadn't come across this previously in the first sort of 20 years of practice. And then during my master's qualification, worked with my first gender questioning child and sort of started reading about it and reading more and more and just thinking what is going on.
So I'm Charles Plummer. I'm a social worker for about 35 years now, background in children and families in various different settings. But the last 18 years or so, I've been a children's guardian with CAFCAS. I've been involved a lot with CAFCAS, sort of challenging the policies and practices within the organisation, And I've also sort of been subject of sort of procedures whereby, I've challenged other professionals around the issues of gender and gender identity. So it's an important topic. I think the tide is turning somewhat, but there's still a lot of work to be done, certainly within terms of policy within the organizations and the kind of frameworks we have to work within.
Oh, hello. I'm Sarah Phillimore. I'm a child protection barrister of about 25 years' experience. I'm really interested in the question around children's capacity to consent to all of this, because that's so inextricably linked to what is in their best interests. And I appreciate there's a tension between paternalism and autonomy, but we seem to have lost our collective minds about what we think is acceptable to the choices we think is acceptable for children to make. So I'm really, really pleased that just recently the courts seem to be waking up to this. Because remember, in 2023, you had the president of the family division happily sending a teenage girl out of the jurisdiction to get her breasts amputated because that wouldn't be permitted in this country. And I think the tide is turning. And I'm really glad we're having this discussion and people are willing to be named because this is the key, isn't it? People have lived in fear of speaking out because of losing their jobs, which I don't judge or criticize anyone because that's huge. But hopefully, if people can listen to this and hear professionals naming themselves and talking about things, it can only help. And obviously, the most important people are the children who are being, I think, encouraged into making really, really stupid decisions, which will haunt them for the rest of their lives. So, yay for open discussion, all in favor of it.
Yeah, great. So I've just realised I should have introduced myself. I felt that I had earlier. But anyway, I'm Maggie Mellon, and equally, I'm totally happy to be named and have been for, well, years now on this topic since about 2017 or 18. And nothing bad has ever happened to me, but I am independent, work mainly independently, and I've not been reported anywhere and not suffered any consequences. And in fact, I think, it's been very fruitful and very useful to be identified as a social worker who is prepared to be critical and to challenge and but I'm so glad there's more of us able to do that now. So we'll move on now to the actual discussion, which is about this. Well, Robin's going to explain what he wrote in his Substack and how he would approach the issue of identifying and assessing the best interests of a child in this situation.
Yeah, so I actually think that one of the places that would be useful for me to start is a little bit of a confession that when I first came across a gender questioning child back in 2019 within my work, my default assumption was to go along with it and facilitate their social transition as they requested new names and pronouns, because I was operating from a place of ignorance. And as I saw this young person change their name and pronouns on a near enough weekly basis and seemed to increase in their overall level of distress, I found myself questioning what we were doing and saying to myself, this feels like there's something more to this that we're missing because we're just going along with this. And that really started me down a, well, 5 years and counting rabbit hole, of looking into how do we best work with gender questioning children and with the topic of gender identity in a social work context. And I've gone back and forth in different ways on this issue, and I decided that the only way I was going to be able to navigate it, particularly given the preponderance of poor quality evidence in this field, was I needed to find some way of grounding myself while exploring the evidence that exists. And what I found was the best place to start is using the Children Act, because the Children's Act outlines pretty much the first principles by which a social worker has to work from. So obviously, Section one says that the welfare of the child is paramount. And what that means is that you can't bring your own preconceptions or your own ideology and place that above the interests of the child, you have to take a step back. So when we're looking at evidence, we have to be open to any possible approach or model of working with them prior to examining that against the evidence. So I can't come in, for example, as someone who would be, although I'm reticent to use the label for all of its connotations, who would be classed by other people perhaps as gender critical. I can't come in and say, well, I assume a priori that this is the way things should be done, regardless of the evidence, just as a trans activist couldn't come in and say, I think that we should use the affirmative model a priori without considering the evidence, because we have to look at what does it mean to place the welfare of the child at the front of our consideration. And within that, there is further principle set in the Children's Act where it outlines that we have to listen to the voice of the child, but it also says that we have to consider it in the context of their developmental stage and their age, and we have to take responsibility as professionals and as adults for the bigger picture and the long term. So we actually have to be considering what the long term impact is on the child and not just immediate gratification of their wishes there and then. And so the article that I wrote that you're referring to was basically just outlining, drawing these principles out as to how we can navigate our way through the evidence so that we have a starting point for that process. I don't know if anyone has anything they want to add to that in terms of if they feel there are additional considerations that I haven't outlined there, or if there's any limitations to that that I'm blind to through my own.
I just think it's fantastic that any social worker is speaking up. I mean, after what happened to Rachel Mead, I'm not surprised there has been silence from the profession, but obviously it's been very difficult because you are the front line, aren't you, of protecting these children. What really troubled me about the CAS review was that looked after children were so overrepresented in the numbers of children seeking gender transition. And I've been really, really shocked by a lot of the cases where the judges have been complicit with the social workers. And I just think we need a more honest account, discussion about this tension between paternalism and autonomy, because I think both have a place in looking after children. And for some bizarre reason, when it comes to gender identity, we've said a child can determine even at the age of 3 that they have a trans identity, and any decision they make must be respected. And I can't criticize social work, because every single profession failed, didn't it? And it's just so interesting, because I thought social workers were more attuned to looking at oppression and systems, and yet they fell just as hard as anyone else. So that's probably just rambling. I'm just really curious as to why, you know, a profession that is supposed to have the welfare of children at the forefront. As you say, the Children Act sets out that the basic principle, the welfare of the child, is paramount. How did we get here? I'm still struggling to understand.
I think I can answer the how we got here, or how do I think we got here as a profession? And that is time constraints and the busyness of social workers. And I think, like many other professions, thought that the advice coming from Stonewall was the best advice available and was the guidance we should be taking. And I think I think Robin mentions it in his article about heuristics and shortcuts, and you know, that is how we as a profession got to this place. Because I mean, as with the Tavistock and not having time to think, I think social work is very pressured, and that can happen in social work as well.
I think it's also that, but you know, we have to practice within we have to sort of be compliant with the policy of whichever our particular organization we work for. And that's where I've come into difficulties, because you know, the policies around these issues which have been written are so heavily influenced by, you know, activist groups from a particular standpoint, and it's not necessarily evidence-based. I mean, Robin's point about returning to first principles. I mean, I hope I understand that perfectly as a social worker, and that's the way I'd approach my analysis of any situation. But when you're working within an organization which says, no, you must do this and you must do it this way, I think that's when you can get into difficulty, and that's certainly where I've got into difficulty. So I hope that's going to change soon, with post-CAS review and a more evidence-based approach. But that's certainly been the experience for a lot of people within this group, myself included.
What Charles, I was going to ask you to comment anyway on just how that approach that Robin was saying there would be defensible in CAFCAS. Or, I mean, obviously, I know that you have found you had real difficulty in pursuing it, but what kind of arguments could they put up against that? That this
Well,
was.
I think CAFCAS being unique in the sense that we're there to represent the child and the child's voice. I think there's a tendency to move towards, well, you must, whatever the child tells you, that's what reality is. But like, who that's incredibly dangerous, and we don't in any other situation when working with children, we don't look at it that way. So I do think it's something happened somewhere along the line, whereas this particular issue around gender identity was seen very differently. And I don't know how that happened. And I think it's probably, the influence of groups like Stonewall and the activism within organizations. And I think it only takes a sort of small group of people within any particular organization to create that level of influence.
Well, I actually think one of the things that Sarah pointed out is key in all of this is that social work has prided itself on its embracing of anti-oppressive practice and similar things, and has tended ideologically to lean more towards the progressive side of things. And a lot of the issues with gender identity have been smuggled in under the guise of being about embracing diversity and anti-oppressive practice. And so I think in some ways the profession was primed to be susceptible to that particular tactic, when the T got tacked on to LGBT and Stonewall and other organizations embraced it. It was very easy for people to say, well, this is the new gay, and there's a lot of latent guilt around what happened to gay people in the past, and rightfully so. Some of it was horrendous, and people who have expressed atypical gender identities and gender behaviors in the past have been treated quite poorly as well, and continue to do so. But what that doesn't mean is that we can't question it at all, and we've fallen into this. I once heard it called child-led rather than child-centered, and I think that summarizes it very well, where rather than listening to the child's voice in context, you're taking the child's voice as fact, which we wouldn't do in any other circumstance. If a child makes an allegation against a parent, for example, we have a duty to look at the evidence and try and find other ways of proving or disproving that allegation. We don't take it at face value and treat every allegation as indication of guilt. One of the interesting things that I noticed this weekend, though, is going over the CAS review for, I don't know, the third or fourth time. I've read it the whole way through now. Social workers or social care are mentioned 10 times in the report. And at the end, when it's making recommendations in terms of training and changes, the British Association of Social Workers are named as one of the organizations that need to be involved in that process of bringing in these changes. But to my knowledge, there's been no acknowledgement of the CAS review so far from BASWA. Someone might prove me wrong, but I have not seen anything to
No.
suggest they've acknowledged it.
Does anybody know? You know, Social Work England were supposed to implement changes, weren't they, in their training along with Westminster City Council? Does anyone know anything about that? Because I remember Social Work England, because I represented Rachel Mead in the fitness to practice hearing. They submitted a document that said a gender recognition certificate changed a person's biological sex. And my jaw hit the floor. This was Social Work England. This was your regulator. So you were supposed to go in and talk to vulnerable children and tell them that if they went down this path, they would actually change their sex. Do you remember the little boy asking one of the doctors at the Tavistock when he would become pregnant? And there was an embarrassed silence and they just quickly moved on. So that I thought was utterly chilling. So I'm really, really concerned because I don't think BASWA has said or done anything. I don't think Social Work England has said or done anything, but weren't they actually required to do so when Rachel won her tribunal? And this just, the capture is so deep that they won't even take notice of the humiliating and expensive legal defeats to which they're subject. Because it's two social workers, isn't it now? Rachel Mead and Lizzie Pitts. Of all the professions, you're overrepresented as being victims of unlawful discrimination about this. Yeah, I'd be really interested if anyone here knows, because I haven't seen a thing from
No,
BASWA or Social Work England.
it's all
I
gone
think
very quiet with Social Work England. I haven't seen or heard anything more.
the most they'll have gone to is saying that being gender critical is a legitimate belief, and that it's not, that's the only apology. They haven't even apologized to Rachel in any way, and they haven't acknowledged fault, and they haven't said they won't actually take action or investigate social workers. However, I have it seems that they're not. And in the case of one of our members who was sacked by, or our t contract was terminated by her authority, and they said they were going to report to SWE, but she never heard anything more about that. So either they didn't report or SWE didn't pick it up. And this was following the Rachel Mead case. So I think things have changed, but they just haven't publicly acknowledged the facts. And I think I understand that BASWA, the chair of BASWA, who's Julia Ross, and I'd been in correspondence with her. She kept fobbing me off and sending me to the officers, but I think she has now made some sort of gesture towards saying, yeah, there's an issue here with the CAS report. So I think things have changed, and I doubt if there'll be another social worker actually in the same position as Rachel Mead. Although I'm in Scotland, of course, and well, things are pretty bad here, but the regulator here isn't, and is actually to date has been recognizing
But
the right of belief and the right of free speech and
that's
not.
but it's all very well to allow us the right to say you're talking bollocks. But if Social Work England have not actually formally resiled from this position that a gender recognition certificate changes biological sex, is that what is expected of practitioners when you are dealing with children in these? And I appreciate these are really distressed children. The comorbidities discovered by the CAS review were just shocking, weren't they? In fact, was it a huge proportion compared to the general population had a parent who was a registered sex offender? And that was the statistic that really jumped out at me.
It was
So,
something like 1 in 10, wasn't it, or something?
yeah, when compared to the general population, that was huge. So I'm just really troubled if there isn't a public recognition by BASWA, by Social Work England, that they were wrong. To what extent do you feel that you're still, I mean, Charles, you certainly must feel that you're still under that cosh. It can't be challenged. You have to go along with it. It's all great. There's no downsides to this. It will cure everything. Is that still the prevailing attitude for social workers?
I think within my organization, it's just all gone very quiet. And I think, post CAS, we're probably in a sort of period of time where there's some thought being given to policy and changing policy, but it's a slow process. I've tried to contribute or offered my input into reviewing policies, but you tend to just get ignored or sidelined or not taken seriously. So I think there is a change is coming, but it's hard to see where from and how it's driven.
I think that the sorry,
Yeah,
go
no,
ahead,
I was
Rob.
just going to say, Robin's your introduction and focus on the Children Act, that do people find that, I mean, for me, that would be an unanswerable, or it is an unanswerable point, and one that I've been making, that, this is completely against any sort of any social work training, is to do this thing to children and not to look at their best interests, not to look at the evidence, and not to make a reasoned judgment about what is the best decision for a child, or to make a recommendation. So I has Robin said he'd had some good experience in work of having actually raised a challenge and being now invited to do the training. And you've had the opposite experience, Charles, of just being completely rejected, and your expertise in the area, your thoughts and guidance have. We've now written, EBSWA has written and asked government in Scotland and in England for guidance, and the same as has been put out for education in England, and been given gobbledygook in replies referring us to completely different things. But it seems to me, I would have some, I think it would have some teeth if we were to be setting that down as the Children Act, the Children Act principles, to be setting them down and saying, look, this is just untenable what's been going on here, and no social, we should all be doing this proper assessment and a proper weighing of interest. Because when what Robin was setting out in his article was very much this, you don't go in with an ideological conviction. In terms of one individual child, one way or another, you can be a sex realist or you can be a trans idealist. But if you are a social worker with a duty to assess and make a recommendation or take forward a plan for a child, then you've got to follow the act and you've got to actually look at the evidence. So I don't see a defence from that, or as I can see, it seems to me that would be a sort of positive way forward in taking the fight forward, really.
So
Emma, yeah.
I think in answer to Sarah's question about, are social workers guided by the fact that Social Work England and BASWA are still quite sort of pro-affirmation, I think, in what they've got on their website. I think it comes down to the policies of the organisation. And as much as we're talking about the welfare of the child is paramount, I think the level of indoctrination of social workers into, how much have they been led to believe that the welfare of the child is improved by transition? And I think disseminating the CAST review is key here. And I know on the team I work with, I don't think any other social worker has heard of the CAST review, to be honest. I asked my manager and he seemed kind of woolly and said I could do a presentation on it. But unfortunately, structural issues have kind of overtaken our life for the last year, in terms of sort of what we're doing and what we're talking about in team meetings. But I've also got the difficult position of the young people that I've worked with have been so close to 18, they're trans identified. They've come, another social worker left, and I sort of took them over 2 months before they turned 18, and they'd been sort of in that identity for a couple of years. So I think the welfare of their welfare is always there in my head and in my thinking, but at the same time, relationship building is a key part of social work. I think it's the most important part of social work. We know from sort of social work. Sorry, my brain is gone. Studies, basically, studies show that relationship building is key in achieving any outcomes, positive outcomes. So, when you are working with older teenagers who've changed their name, and have been identifying as the opposite sex for a while, I think you have to work on building that relationship. And actually, one of the priorities of my team is homelessness. So housing is usually a priority above sort of gender identity. And as my manager said, we're not referring them for health services, but it's just still there in my head. Like, I don't want these young people to go on and harm themselves, having seen the evidence. So I just gently kind of bring it in. Oh, you know, surgery always comes with, you know, it's inherently dangerous. You know, I really want you to think about it if that's something you're thinking about doing in the future. But yeah, I think. So coming down back to welfare of the child, I think yes, it depends what the social worker believes is, and we need to disseminate that evidence. We need to share the CAS review and share that you know, as well, the suicide myth that has now been debunked. We need to kind of share that with social workers widely.
Yeah, but on the relationship front, and I agree with you. I mean, I think relationship is everything in terms of being working with people. I Jen Speck, you know, Stella O'Malley's work is, I find that really useful about not having the kind of argument with a young person like you know, you are, you aren't, it isn't, it's like, you know, but to actually be saying, asking them really curiously, genuinely. Why is it important to you? What does it mean to you? You know, how does it make you happier, or does it make you know, those kind of questions are, I think, at the heart of building a relationship with a child that isn't going to, or a young person that isn't going to be about you're wrong, you can't do this. Because from my experience, a lot of children in care, it's the only thing they've been listened to and allowed to make a decision about. They can say they want to go home, or they can say they don't want to be at home. They can say they, you know, they can, whatever they say has never actually been a major turning point in, or it's not been acted on. But the minute they say that they're trans, it is acted on, and they, and so therefore they, I can see why they think it's really important and why it makes them feel better and more empowered and all of these things, because it's, yeah, it's no surprise that it's a lot of children in care who, and girls in care who are amongst the, you know, disproportionate numbers of them are identifying as trans, because it's the one thing you're allowed to do. So I do think in terms of having the discussions, that kind of practice is maybe something that could be easier or more acceptable in a social work audience, or in a, you know, it's how do we do these conversations with children and young people and their parents, rather than how do we get them to not do it, or how do we get them to desist or whatever. Does that make any sense to anybody?
Yeah,
I
I
think.
completely agree. Sorry. And I was going to say, yeah, and I think that comes back to Robin's position of not taking either ideological stance and being neutral, which I do. I love Stella O'Malley and Jen Speck's work and Sasha Ryad and their conversations. And it's, I guess it's, and it's should be bread and butter for social workers, professional curiosity and just gently exploring subjects with the young people we work with and the families as well.
Yeah, no, it's very important. Like, being neutral is not the same as affirmation, is it? And that's what we, that's the line we have, we would take, you know, building relationship with any young person. The other sort of issue, I think, for you know, us working in child safeguarding is, you know, the role of other professions, isn't it? And we can you know, take a neutral approach, but you know, if a child's in a school which is particularly keen on affirmation, or they're, you know, involved with CAMHS, where, you know, they're equally sort of take that approach, it's very difficult, isn't it? And I think right across the board, it's going to take some time for the findings of CAS, particularly around social transitioning to start to shift things.
Well, I was going to bring in the fact that the CAS review made very clear about social transition, that from a clinical perspective, it should be considered an active intervention. So it's not neutral. And while it also has to be acknowledged that sometimes these young people will have engaged in some level of social transition themselves, sometimes their family or friends or even other institutions or professionals may have engaged in that, that we still have to treat it as an active intervention and consider it in those terms. And when you read, to get to grips with the CAS review from a social work perspective, because it isn't aimed at social work specifically, you have to sort of read through it and connect bits, sometimes not in chronological order. And it says that while social transition is an active intervention, it says that these measures have been a unprecedented departure from usual practice because we've sort of adopted them with very, very little evidence to suggest that they're right. And Emma, what you said about relationship, I think the welfare of the child, like you were saying, it's about not coming in with preconceptions, because what is in the best interest of any child is going to be unique to that child, because they all live in complex and unique environments with many different influences. And again, I know I've referred back to it about 50 times in the speaking that I've done, but the CAS review sort of highlighted that the route to a trans identity or to questioning one's gender is going to be different for every single child. And so our responsibility is to not come in saying, well, that means that we have to affirm them, or that means we have to argue with them and convince them otherwise. We have to go, okay, what's behind that? What's the reason that they've come to this? What function does this identity serve for them? Because for some, it could be that they were sexually abused and they're trying to get away from the sex that their sex at birth, because they feel that that makes them vulnerable to further instances of abuse. They might have seen domestic abuse in their lives and they might feel that they don't want to be the victim or they don't want to be the perpetrator. And so they identify away from the sex of the person that they've sort of identified with in that way. It could be any other array of complicated things that are all playing a slight part each. And we're never going to know that without finding out what is the situation for that one child. And to do that, we have to take a neutral, exploratory, questioning approach. So to give an example, a few years ago had a 10-year-old who said that he wanted to be a girl. And I remember having this conversation with him where I was having a battle with school, actually, who were trying to affirm. And I was sort of saying, I don't think we should affirm because we don't know what's going on here yet. We need to find that out. And I suggested to school that rather than use his name or use pronouns, because you don't need to use pronouns when speaking to someone one-to-one ever, really, that they ask if they can just refer to him by name, or if they could get around it using pet names. This is something that's generally easier for women, I will say. For men, it sounds a bit creepy if you call a kid Petal or Duck or anything like that. Women get away with it a little bit more. But, you can sort of use those pet names that you would use generally to anyone to avoid ever actually using their name. And school was saying, we can't do that. Won't accept it. So I had a conversation with the child and I said, I think you're trying to make a very big decision here and I don't want to push my decision on you and I want to hear your decision. So why don't we find a middle ground? How about I just refer to you by your name? And he said, yeah, straight away, without question. It wasn't an issue. And when I asked him, so what does this mean to you? You know, what does it mean to be a boy or what does it mean to be a girl? He said that boys were violent and girls are pretty. And that was as sophisticated as his understanding of it came. And after some further exploration, it turned out that in his home, where there was a lot of issues going on, he had mostly brothers and there was one girl in the family who was a baby. And so everyone took extra care with this girl. And because he also said to me later on that he didn't want to be the age he was and he wanted to be the same age as her. So he was basically trying to take on the role of this baby in the family because everyone cared for it and he didn't like the treatment that he was getting in the role that he had. So I wouldn't have known that if I'd have taken either an affirmative approach or if I'd taken a hypercritical approach that would have led to conflict. So you have to build the relationship, and that is something that is always going to be part of making a decision about what's in the best interest of the child. You're weighing many different things at any given time, because it's not in the child's long-term interest for you to break down that relationship by challenging them too much. It's not in their short-term interest to break down that relationship. It's in most cases, it's probably not going to be in their long-term interest to go down a medical pathway, but there are some points where we're not going to be able to stop that, and we have to think to ourselves, okay, how do we support this person while they're making their own autonomous decisions to the degree that they are, and trying to open up space for reflection and questioning? And this is something that should be familiar to any social worker, is we cannot get the optimum outcome in every situation, and some children are going to suffer, some children are going to have adverse outcomes, and we just have to open up the opportunity as best we can to minimizing that happening.
That was really well said, Robin. Thank you.
Yeah, I wonder though, when you're saying you must go into any situation with thinking that there's a different solution, or it could be a different approach to every child. But I mean, there are some, and I do agree with you in general about the need to not to go in and actually weigh up the evidence. But there are some things that we do know are not in the best interests of children, like very basic things, like they should not be sexually abused, introduced to sexual experiences that are inappropriate for them. They should not be starved. They should not be fed alcohol. Do you know? So there are some things that we just go, no, no way. I'm not going to assess this. I'm just going to say alcohol in children is a no. I mean, obviously, as the child gets older, and you go 14-year-old and a cider in a red, yeah, you know, you can have those discussions, but there are some things we generally just are not good for children, not in their best interest. So I think there has to be some parameter, and the thing about this discussion is that some of the things that we know are not good for children are being inflicted on them, and so there is a need to kind of go, no, wait a minute. You know, in a safeguarding role, you can't be doing this.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that part of the issue, because one of the things that I raised in my article is about parental responsibility and how that gives parents the rights to make decisions about their children. And it's very explicitly stated in the Children's Act that we can't intervene unless there is evidence that the child's going to come to harm. And in terms of legal thresholds, a lot of the evidence isn't there at the moment to say that in terms of social transition, the evidence isn't strong enough in either direction for us to conclusively say that any social transition constitutes significant harm. If it was the case of, say, a young person getting illicit hormones off the internet, then we have evidence for that, particularly if parents are facilitating that. And there has been legal precedent of a judge ruling that it's inappropriate for a child to be getting hormones from gender GP, it was. And there was also a case in 2016 where a judge ruled that a mother socially transitioning a 9-year-old to live as a girl was causing emotional harm, and the judge said that the 9-year-old should be cared for by dad, who wasn't socially transitioning them, and the 9-year-old quickly reverted back to male typical behavior. And so it was very apparent that that was a fabricated illness. And this is something that's been raised both in Hannah Barnes's book Time to Think, when she was speaking with the clinicians at the Gender Identity Development Service, and in the CAST review, is that there have been a small number, but any number is enough for us to have to consider it, of cases where young people are presenting as gender questioning or wishing to adopt another identity, where parents have been the primary driver for that, which should be treated in the same way as we would were parents generating any other illness. And I'm not I spoke slightly loosely there, saying that a trans identity is not inherently an illness, but you know, if that is being created by the parent to serve the parent's interests and it's not in the interests of the child, then we have grounds to say that that's harming them.
Yeah, the test of significant harm is important because without that being the case, there is no grounds for social workers to be making any sort of decision or recommendation about a child's best interests. It just doesn't, it's not there. But if you were looking at a situation where a child was being encouraged or allowed or not prevented from harming themselves and or coming to serious harm, that's when one would expect child protection guidance to be followed. But in fact, in these cases, it is like in Scotland, the care inspector actually recommends the promotion of gender identity in children care and of sharing bedrooms and toilets and of opposite sexes if the according to how they identify. So basic safeguarding, which is to prevent and protect children from significant harm, is in my view being breached enormously by this affirmative approach.
I think, Robin, I think the case of the 9-year-old you're referring to, was it Ree J? I think, yeah. I think, you know, the judge made various comments in his judgment, didn't he, about the role of professionals and sort of losing sight of first principles and abandoning common sense. And I think he was highly critical of you know, professionals in that case as well.
Yeah, the concerning thing is that that was in 2016, and I've read a 2022 case where a judge ruled to change a child's name legally, which is effectively mandating social transition, which, as we have already highlighted, is an active intervention that wasn't being undertaken under clinical supervision as a result of that judge's decision. I think one of the places where it gets really clear that sometimes there are areas where the line between social transition and medical transition is blurry, such as tucking and breast binders, because in general, Cass was very clear that partial social transition is always going to be a better option than full social transition because it allows more flexibility. What Cass didn't go into is sort of specifics, but my interpretation of that is that children experimenting with how they present themselves and how they appear is quite normal. We've had many subcultures where children will take, you know, adopt an outlandish appearance that their parents may disapprove of, or that may not make sense to the adults around them, but that's part of their individuation process. It's a natural part of adolescence. But when we have things like breast binders coming in, where there's zero evidence that a breast binder reduces emotional distress or psychological distress, there's zero evidence that that's going to lead to better long-term outcomes, but there is evidence that it can cause deformation of the breast tissue, that it can damage ribs, that it can cause restricted breathing. And if we are facilitating that, and I have come across cases with looked after children where the local authority has purchased breast binders, for example.
So have I, yep.
Yeah. And if we're facilitating that, then actually we are abdicating our safeguarding duty by engaging in a harmful practice without any evidence. And that is a significant concern. And this is why I think that we need the top down guidance, because while there isn't any clear guidance coming from BASWA or Social Work England, we're going to be in a situation where people's experience is going to be heavily dependent on individual social workers and individual social workers, because, you know, most social workers, particularly frontline social workers, have to work with a wide range of issues, and it's impossible for them to be well read on all of those issues. So you're going to get some who just go along with, I mean, it's very easy to be completely bamboozled by a young person who's sitting there going, well, this is why I need this, and this is why I need this, and here's where I've got the evidence for this, and here's all this new terminology that you don't know. And the number one question I get asked by people is, how, what do the words mean? What does all the language around this mean? And my advice to people is usually, don't listen to the words, try and think what they're trying to communicate with the words, because the words themselves are a bit of a distraction, and just try and understand it. And also, you can just ask young people what they mean, and they'll be happy to explain it, but just keep asking why until you really get to the bottom. Don't take the first explanation at face value. But so yeah, we are always going to be in this situation where some social workers just don't know what they're doing. And because it's so politicized, I think Cass said that basically the young people get completely lost while and used as political pawns while people are busy arguing about them. And that's is what's happening. But because it's so politicized, a lot of people don't want to work with it. And one of the issues that they're having in the NHS with developing the new services is that people are afraid to work with this client group. And the same thing happens in social care. It's just less apparent because a lot of social workers are like, I don't want to set a foot wrong while I'm working with these clients. And so they feel completely paralyzed in how to act. And it almost hypnotizes them into going completely off path away from their typical practice.
What do we think would is going to wake up social work leadership to the risks and harms of what they're advocating, or to being aware that they might be held accountable for it? What at what point or in what way can we make that more of an issue? Because it does seem to me as if they feel quite protected. Maybe less so now, but at what point would they not begin to draw back or begin to question what they're advocating, which is often physical harm to children and possibly for girls, of course, the risk of pregnancy and sexual abuse and other things because of being encouraged or to identify as being male when they're not, which is obviously a huge risk to them. So
I'm thinking that we need to go to the top because it's come from the top down. So I think that maybe EBSWHA as a group needs to do a presentation to the social work, like the leader. I can't remember what it is, but there's a group, isn't there, where all the kind of directors of children's services meet. Maybe something like that.
I think they wouldn't hear us. It's been we've offered to do workshops at conferences and to, you know, and I've offered to do things with BASWA and to have a discussion, the debate, the argument, and they at the moment they're not for hearing us. But you know, I think we have written to government asking for guidance. We have written, I've written to in Scotland, it's called Social Work Scotland. It used to be the Directors of Social Work. I think in England, it's called the Association of Directors of Children's Services.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. So I suppose we could do another approach to them just to say, don't you think it's time we had this discussion again? But it certainly is time that we had the discussion again. I'm conscious of the time, and it's now like 1 minute to 8:30 when we're due to finish. Has anybody got any last things that they would like to ask, say, propose?
I suppose just picking up on that last point. I mean, it goes right to government, doesn't it? And you know, I think we've tried certain, you know, trying to talk to certain people and ministers and so on, but you generally just get fobbed off. But I think, you know, I get the sense, you know, Wes Streeting seems to be somebody who's taking all these concerns quite seriously post Cass. You know, I don't really even understand who's ultimately responsible for children's social care, but you know, that's probably what we should be thinking about targeting as well, isn't it?
I think that I don't want to comment too heavily on Social Work England and BASWA, primarily because I don't know what's going on behind the scenes, but I do know that there's always a lot of inertia with these things, and the CAS review is relatively recent in terms of policy changes and how things tend to trickle down. But I do think that it's going to be a bit part process where it needs the bottom-up process, which I guess is us. And others like us. It needs the top down change. And I also think that part of it is going to be in the next 5 years or so, as a lot of the young people who have been affirmed by social workers and who have detransitioned in adulthood will then come back and sue the local authorities. And that will initiate a bit more speed. That'll speed things up, I'd imagine, because everyone who's worked in social care for any length of time has seen the things that the local authorities get sued for by former looked after children. There's all sorts of negligence that comes up, and it's very hard for me to believe that a lot of the practice that's gone on with this particular client group won't fall into that category at some point in the near future.
Yeah,
Right.
agreed. Yeah.
Okay. Right. I think we'll let Robin have the last word there on that one. So thanks very much, everybody, for your contribution. And we'll repeat this again and have another topic for discussion in a month or so. So thanks very much and good night.